Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. The governor brokers a deal between public and charter schools. Find out which side will take more control. Plus, a fire and a race-fueled riot in Pasadena right off of Colorado Boulevard? Sound impossible, but there was a time way back.
We forget that L.A. area was a little bit of the Wild West, and it was really only when we started, you know, the railroad came and we became a little more urban, we got police force.
It's all ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for choosing us. If you had a show, we would choose you back. Coming up on today's show, we'll hear how law enforcement is using video from Ring doorbells to help solve crimes.
You know, these cameras are high-definition, motion-detecting, internet-connected. They provide a lot of good stuff if you're an investigator on the beat pursuing some sort of crime.
That story coming up in about 15 minutes. But first, public and charter school advocates have come together on a statewide deal. In short, it would give public school districts more local control over the opening and oversight of charters. Now, it's a big victory for Governor Gavin Newsom, who brokered the deal. To give us the details of what this might mean for schools right here in Southern California, we have Pedro Noguera. He's a professor at the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies at UCLA. Welcome.
Great to be with you.
Sure. Now, okay, walk us through some of the big bullet points in this compromise.
I think the big point is that now local districts will have more say over the authorization of charter schools, which means also more oversight. Which is important because in many districts, there has not been a real collaborative relationship with charters. In some cases, charters have really been imposed on districts, even when the district didn't want it. So I think this changes things quite a bit. But it also requires the teachers in charter schools to have same credentials as teachers in public schools and much greater transparency in terms of use of funds, public funds. So I think these are all good things.
When it comes to the oversight, what was behind the calls for more oversight?
Well, there have been several cases in recent years, financial mismanagement and in some cases outright corruption at some charter schools. And I think this gave real reason for policymakers to say that we need to make sure public money is being spent on children and not going into the hands of the charter owners. And while I think there's just a small number of those cases in California, in some states there have been many incidents like this. So the need for transparency and fiscal responsibility, I think, is a serious matter.
You know, this deal has been a long time coming. What was in it for charter schools to get on board for this?
I think charter schools have seen for a while now that the political landscape's changed. Their allies in Sacramento have gone. They had a lot of support from Governor Brown. That's not the case under Governor Newsom. And so I think they realized they needed a compromise if they were really going to avoid something that they might have interpreted as far more harmful to their interest.
We're talking about a new deal between public schools and charter schools with Pedro Noguera. He's the professor of Graduate School Education and Information Studies at UCLA. Now, because this deal would lead to more local control, let's look at what would happen here in Southern California, specifically with LA Unified School District. Practically speaking, Pedro, what would happen to LAUSD schools?
I think that the board, which is already very divided on this issue, could start to raise questions that haven't been raised in the past, such as looking at special ed enrollment. There's some evidence that many charter schools under-enroll students with learning disabilities, which means public schools are taking more of those students. You could create a more level playing field simply by requiring more fairness in the access for those students. Same is true for English learners and the fiscal oversight. I think it's going to be a challenge for the board to reach consensus on how to do this because they are so divided, but now they have the authority.
Could there be some lingering, maybe distrust between both sides here? I mean, this debate, this fight seemingly has been going on for a while now. Could there be some issues maybe trying to get these compromises done?
I think so. I think we will at least initially see a lot of wrangling and probably some conflict at the board level between the advocates on both sides. So it'll be up to the board to try to figure out how do we come up with an objective approach to monitoring charter schools and overseeing them and authorizing them.
Yeah, that sounds like it puts a lot of pressure on the board to appear fair at the very least.
Absolutely. And I think fairness is really what's called for here. I mean, if we look closely and fairly at it, there are some charters that are outperforming district schools, even when you control for the population served. we should have been looking at those schools a long time ago to understand what do they do differently and how can we bring some of those strategies into public schools. That hasn't happened. I'm hoping that we can move in that direction eventually. We should have, for many years, tried to make sure that public schools have some of the same advantages that charter schools have in terms of reducing some of the regulations that make it difficult to run a school. But that hasn't occurred, and I hope hopefully this will allow for it.
That's Pedro Noguera, professor at the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies at UCLA. Thanks for the time.
Thank you.
All right, now to immigration policy. California Senators Kamala Harris and Dianne Feinstein have filed a joint letter with other members of Congress asking the Trump administration to stop the so-called Remain in Mexico policy, now called the Migrant Protection Protocols, or MPP, by the White House. The rule blocks asylum seekers who argue their lives are threatened in their home countries from staying in the United States while they await court hearings and must instead stay south of the border until their cases are called. Molly O'Toole is an immigration reporter with the LA Times and joined us this morning to talk about it.
What it does is it essentially makes it almost nearly impossible for an asylum seeker who presents themselves at the border to win asylum in the United States, because it has created an entirely new process outside of the one that had been created through a series of laws and what lawmakers had set for the U.S. immigration system. Instead of doing that credible fear interview, asylum seekers are now put into a separate interview process, and they're being screened for fear of persecution not in their home countries, but in Mexico. And then also that standard that is used to screen their asylum claim is much higher. It's this entirely new standard. And the way asylum officers tended to explain it is basically 10% chance that they would face persecution. They're now having to prove a 51% chance, a more likely than not, of persecution, and not in their home countries, but in Mexico.
All right, so they're sent back while they wait for their asylum cases to go through the courts. First off, where specifically are they sent to?
Well, where they're sent back to depends on where they claimed asylum. But the majority cities where they're being pushed back are Tijuana in northwest Mexico, Juarez, which is across from El Paso, Texas. And then now, since June, the policy has been expanded across the entire border. So they're also being pushed back to cities such as Nuevo Laredo and Matamoros, which are across from different parts of the border in Texas. And those are in the Mexican state of Tamaulipas, which the U.S. State Department considers to be on the same level of danger, level 4, do not travel, as Syria, as Iraq, as Afghanistan.
Wow.
These are some of the most dangerous cities in the world where they are being forced to wait.
And there's some pretty grim stories from those who are waiting in these places, waiting for their cases to be called. Tell us about some of the people you've spoken to.
Well, some of the people that I spoke to over the last several months, I mean, there was a family who had actually sought asylum in Calexico, which is in southeastern California, and they didn't even realize this was a possibility, but it's a family of six, a father, a mother, and four kids, two older kids, but two very young children. They claimed asylum, and they were told to come back to the border a month later, but 130 miles away in Tijuana, where they would come across for their hearing in San Diego and then be sent back to Tijuana and have to figure out how to get back to Mexicali. And this family did not want to stay in Tijuana. It was a city they didn't know, they hadn't been to, but also because the migrants themselves know that some of these cities are extremely dangerous. But in the meantime, unable to obtain work permits from the Mexican government, despite promises that they would receive those, this family's essentially on the street with a family of six, 115-degree heat in Mexicali, selling candy just to sort of night by night to try and find enough money to have somewhere to stay. And that was just one example. Another woman, Daniela Diaz, a teenager traveling on her own all the way from El Salvador. She'd been threatened by both the gangs and then a local police officer who had said he would protect her but then threatened her. Travels on her own, arrives in Tijuana to basically be caught up in the chaotic rollout of this policy. She was in the courtroom when the policy was blocked, was taken into detention in the United States, and was sent back to Tijuana again when the policy was allowed to resume. And these cities, I mean, it's well documented. You know, there are hundreds of examples of asylum seekers in this program that have been subjected to violence in these cities, including by Mexican officials themselves, corrupt Mexican officials. And at this point, you have cartels, local gangs, various criminal actors who are actually waiting outside the ports of entry for the asylum seekers who are being sent back, because everyone understands that this program is quite significant now. And, you know, you have 37,000 people who are sort of stuck in these border cities, very vulnerable to the kinds of violence that Mexicans themselves are subjected to, but on another level because they stick out in a different way.
Yeah, and these stories are really, really heartbreaking. But okay, at the end of this, how is this policy violating U.S. law?
There's the essential question about the policy itself, whether or not that is legal. And there's ongoing litigation about that. Hearings on the legality of the policy will happen in the Ninth Circuit in October. But the ruling that allowed the policy to resume in May, two out of the three judges expressed serious concerns about the legality of the program. Now, they weren't ruling on the legality at the time, but they still expressed concerns about it. One said it was an impossible reading of the law, the government's argument that they had the legal authority under the Immigration Nationality Act to push asylum seekers back to the contiguous country from which they came while they awaited the proceedings. Another one said that the procedures that they've implemented to put this policy into place are so counter to their stated goal, they now call this program the Migrant Protection Protocols, as to be arbitrary and capricious. Just one quick example is the government is required to put down an address where the asylum seeker or the migrant who's in their court proceedings in that process, where they can be reached. But because they're being sent back to Mexico, some of them to Mexican cities that they didn't even pass through, they don't have an address. Yeah. They don't even know they're going to be sent back. And so CBP officers are putting down the phrase domicilio conocido, which means known address, or general delivery is a more loose translation, or they're simply putting down the country, Mexico, the region,
just the country, Mexico.
Exactly. Okay. Or the city, Tijuana, which is this, you know, a city of 2 million people. But basically, this means it's almost essentially impossible for them to get notification about any changes to their court hearings, to their case. And if they don't receive that notification, it increases the likelihood they won't show up to court, which increases the likelihood that the government will be able to issue an in absentia removal order. And that, even though they've already been removed to Mexico, is sort of the irony of that. But it basically means that they could be potentially blocked from the United States for at least a decade or more, and then sort of indefinitely barred from winning asylum in the United States at all.
Talking to Molly O'Toole with the LA Times about the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico asylum policy. What's Homeland Security or Customs and Border Protection saying about this?
Well, they've really been touting the policy. They see it, like I said, the CBP commissioner, who's the head of that Customs and Border Protection, the agency that's primarily implementing this policy, Mark Morgan, he's called it a game changer. They see it as the most significant contributor to why the numbers of apprehensions at the border, which is generally how they measure the levels of migration at the U.S.-Mexico border, for why they've been going down. And they've dropped by, I believe it's about 60% from May to August. They credit it as being the most significant policy. And at the same time, as they say that the policy is for the migrants' protection, they call it the Migrant Protection Protocols. They actually changed the name from Remain in Mexico. While they say it's for their own protection, at the same time, he acknowledges, Morgan does, that it's a deterrent, that they hope it will be forcing people to give up on their asylum claims. Mm. And there's some indication that that is true.
And are all asylum officials on board with this?
Well, the really interesting aspect of this is the Department of Homeland Security, on a more fundamental level, it's very much at war with itself. These sort of ever-changing directives coming out of the White House and the way they're being implemented, the different roles that various aspects of Homeland Security are being forced to take on. But in particular, the asylum officers, who are really the front lines of this, who are screening the applicants under this policy, they've expressed concerns, you know, very early and very often. They believe it's illegal for the very basic reason that it's knowingly putting people back in harm's way. You know, we've been told by half a dozen USCIS personnel, that's the agency that the asylum officers are part of, you know, that people are quitting in significant numbers, that there's a number of officers across the country who are refusing to implement the policy. We had one federal asylum officer who told us, you know, in 99% of these interviews, the person is saying that they fear being returned to Mexico, but they're being returned anyway.
Now, we know there's a huge backlog of asylum cases in the United States. So where do things stand with cases associated with Remain in Mexico?
So up until this point, it certainly the Remain in Mexico cases had been contributing to the backlog, but it wasn't clear how much so. And there's some data that came out very recently from Syracuse University that one out of every four cases that was added in July to the whole immigration docket were remain in Mexico cases. And now we have judges that are essentially being asked to do nothing else, put aside immigration judges, put aside all of their casework in order to prioritize these cases. And we also have the administration is trying to start these sort of border courts that will be outside of public purview. Generally speaking, the Justice Department is required to allow the public to access these immigration hearings, which is how also part of how we were able to watch them. It's been indicated so far that these new border courts that are going to be along the border to process the remain in Mexico cases, the public isn't going to be allowed to access them. It's certainly contributing significantly to this backlog, which, as I said, is 970,000 cases. It's probably soon to hit a million. And I should also note that it came out this week that the administration is moving, I think it's over $150 million from other aspects of the Homeland Security budget, from FEMA in the middle of hurricane season, from the Coast Guard, in order to support and continue to expand this Remain in Mexico program. So it's a major priority for them. The president's stated goal is to restrict immigration, and this has arguably been his single most successful policy, 37,500 and more cases, and only one person under the program is known to have won the ability to stay in the U.S. in the last 7 months.
That's Molly O'Toole with the L.A. Times telling us about the Trump administration's Remain in Mexico asylum policy. Molly, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to read more about this story, just go to our website, take2.org. All right, more and more homeowners are installing doorbells with a live video component. Someone rings, and if you're not home, you can talk to them through your phone, which is connected to the doorbell. They won't know one way or the other if you're home or away. The rest of the time, the doorbell's camera is always rolling, always recording anything going on in your front yard. But how would you feel if your local police department was also watching what you were seeing right along with you? Find out all about it when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Emmy Martinez. Some homeowners might have a Pavlovian reaction to that sound. For the uninitiated, that's the chime of the popular Ring doorbell that not only alerts you to a visitor at your door, but also captures via video everything in its vicinity. Since 2013, the company's line of internet-connected ringers has caught on camera everything from package thieves to stray animals, and that triggers an alert to the homeowner's smartphone and a live-streamed video. Over the years, the company has teamed up with police agencies across the country to allow access to certain videos. But up until recently, it wasn't clear just how many departments were involved in the partnership. Well, we know that number now, more than 400, including 31 in California. Drew Harwell wrote about this for The Washington Post. Drew, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
All right, just to start, Ring is owned by Amazon. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos owns The Washington Post. Now, with that out of the way, 400 partnerships. LAPD is included in there. How do these video sharing partnerships work exactly?
It is a special kind of data sharing deal where the police who partner up with Ring get their own what they call a neighbor's portal. But it's just a fancy website that an officer can go on. They see like a map interface. They can draw a box around the area where they're investigating a crime. They put in a few details like the case that they're pursuing, the date range, the time. And then Ring sends out these emails to any Ring homeowner in that area, just asking them, do you want to share your video, whatever was captured by your doorbell camera, with the police and potentially help in whatever investigation is happening?
So I get to decide, though, right?
Yeah, the user can say no, or the user can say, yes, here's everything. Ring offers this as the user is in control, the homeowner can consent to help, or they can, you know, say no and never get their request again.
Now, just to be clear, I got, live feeds. That's what a lot of people have on Ring, live feeds. Police officers don't have access to that, do they?
Right. No, they don't have ongoing or live video access. They can't just patch in when you don't know. They get special video clips from Ring. And when you have a Ring, you have like a whole gallery of video that has been recorded anytime the motion detector goes off. It's just those clips. But even if you say no, too, there are certain ways that police can get kind of legal clearance through something like a search warrant or a court order that would still allow them to see the video down the road.
Why do law enforcement agencies say they want access to the videos?
You know, they feel like the more evidence, the better. You know, in these residential neighborhoods where it's just a lot of homes and not really any cameras besides these doorbells are more eyes for them. And, you know, in a lot of these cases, the things that these doorbell cameras are picking up are things like package theft, vandals, other sort of shady characters.
Yeah.
These are cases that the police wouldn't have any leads to go off of anyway. And so they feel like, hey, the more cameras, the more audio and video we can pour into our system. And, you know, these cameras are high definition, motion detecting, internet connected. They provide a lot of good stuff if you're an investigator on the beat pursuing some sort of crime.
Now, up until recently, it wasn't known how widespread the sharing partnership was. How did this number come to light?
Some of us have been cobbling together our own informal estimates based off information we had. We had, you know, news reports. So a couple of us had gotten up to 200 or 300. And finally, I think after annoying Ring probably with these requests, they have finally decided to kind of put that data out there. And, you know, they have 400 police agencies who are signed on. There are 18,000 police agencies across the country. So it's not everybody. But you can tell by the pace of growth that police see some interest here, and Ring is more than happy to help set them up.
Talking about Ring doorbell video sharing with Drew Harwell, who wrote about this for the Washington Post. Now, there are differing opinions over whether millions of connected video cameras make neighborhoods across the country safer. And taking the police out of the equation for a second, there is some controversy over how neighborhoods share their videos amongst themselves, especially when it comes to reports of suspicious activity. Drew, I've seen this a million times, and sometimes I'm like, nah, that's not that suspicious. So when can things get controversial?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, sometimes the clips are really obvious crimes, people taking packages off the doorstep. But a lot of them are in this gray territory where it'll be somebody who's coming up and knocking on the door and just leaving without incident. And when you go onto Ring's social network, which is called Neighbors, it's like a crime-oriented feed where people can post official crime reports, but also just sort of discussions about, hey, did you see this sort of suspicious person walking down the street? You start to get a little unsettled because everybody's idea of who doesn't belong in a neighborhood is very different. And of course, you think about the factors of racial profiling. We've seen kids in these examples too, where there have been clips of, you know, there was one last year, it was Halloween, these couple of young kids knocked on a door and, you know, said trick or treat and then left without incident. Nothing happened. But the homeowner posted that video onto the social network and said, look at these kids. Are they up to no good? And there was this discussion that came after that video where some people were saying, I would watch out for them. And other people saying, are you crazy? Like, these are two young kids. They've done nothing wrong. And yet their image and their voices and their faces are on this, you know, social network devoted to crime.
Now, Ring has given free cameras to police departments, asking them to distribute them to homeowners. And you write that for months, Ring has tried to keep the actual details of that police partnership program confidential. What's been uncovered about how they work with departments?
They work pretty closely with the departments. And I think, you know, there has been some great public record-based reporting by outlets like Vice's Motherboard and Gizmodo and CNET, where they have gone to these specific police departments working with Ring, and they get the emails and they get the kind of correspondence between Ring and the police. You know, Ring has taken they've been a very active kind of participant in this because I think they realize how it can be perceived. And so they've been careful to frame it as, this is something that will contribute to public safety. This is not Big Brother. This is not surveillance. And so, you know, some police officers have talked about it in a way, and then Ring has sort of reminded them, hey, we want to talk about it not in surveillance and security terms, but as this helpful tool. So it has been interesting kind of seeing that interplay, and some of the privacy and civil liberties advocates worry about there being too much overlap between, you know, a public safety agency that has this mission that's devoted to the public good and, you know, a business like Ring that has financial goals in mind.
Now, just to complicate things even more, Ring applied for a facial recognition patent last year that would alert owners when a suspicious person is caught on camera. Ring parent company Amazon is already developing software of their own. Drew, what could possibly go wrong?
When people think about this stuff and start to think about Big Brother, facial recognition always comes up. It has seemed very science fiction for a long time, very sort of future dystopia. It's not that futuristic anymore. I mean, Amazon, obviously, which owns Ring, they develop a facial recognition software that police departments are using right now, actually, to scan, you know, footage they find out in the wild against mugshots to potentially find people. And so, you know, them both having similar corporate owners, them both sort of being based around capturing these really clear photos of people's faces, there's no technical barrier anymore, really. Ring has talked about their ambitions and growing to cover every police agency in the country. And they've talked about, you know, an interest in developing the technology, too. And on that patent filing last year, they were suggesting, well, you could have sort of a positive list. You could put the images of your friends and family on the list, and then you would get a nice alert that, hey, your daughter is home or whatever. But you could also have kind of a ban list. And anytime somebody came to your door that you didn't want to see, you could get an alert there. And so I think for some people, they would feel like, hey, that's a great technology. I would love to see that. But for other people, they see this is a level of maybe surveillance and data ownership by these private companies that I'm a little leery of. So yeah. The future plans are going to be really fascinating to watch.
Drew Harwell writes about technology for The Washington Post. Drew, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, staying at home, nearly 40% of California's 18 to 34-year-olds still live with their parents. Thankfully, for now, not mine. Oof. Now, that's not a shock to anyone with adult children struggling to afford rent here. I mean, after all, the median price of a house in L.A. County as of July is $635,000. That's an all-time high. But what's it like to date when you're in your 20s and still living at home? And where do you get intimate if mom and dad are just down the hall? As part of our California Dream Project, Cal Matters reporter Matt Levin asked younger Californians how they're adapting to this new normal. And for parents, this story does contain some references to sex.
It's a Saturday night at Patsy's Irish Pub in Mission Viejo, a wealthy part of Orange County. Patsy's looks like a lot of other California bars in 2019. Off-key karaoke, a crowd of people vaping outside, and loads of 20 and 30-year-olds who still live with their parents.
I'm here right now getting drunk with my mom.
Jacob Ostheimer is 24. He lives with his mom and stepdad. So does his wife, who right now is on the dance floor with the rest of his family.
We had an apartment here for like 2 years, but I was spending like $30,000 a year in rent. And I could have had that in my savings right now.
In this part of Orange County, 55% of 18 to 34-year-olds live with their parents, one of the highest rates in the state. Drop an IPA randomly inside Patsy's, and you're bound to splash a millennial still living with their parents, like Remy.
My older sister and her boyfriend also live with us, and my sister's 28.
Remy's 25 and says her parents invited her and her boyfriend to live with them, and her sister's boyfriend. Even though it's a pretty full house, Remy says she and her boyfriend can be intimate pretty much like any other couple.
We have a downstairs bedroom. Everyone's upstairs. They really stay out of our way and don't really, like, care what we do.
In my day, one never took a boy home. Never.
Helen Fisher is a senior research professor at the Kinsey Institute who studies love and sex. She says parents are a lot more permissive these days.
Some people will be very pleased with it because they get to know their child in a new way and they get to know some of the people that they are going around with, their helicopter parents.
But not every parent is okay with it, which means some young Californians living at home are resorting to a tried and true form of privacy. A Hyundai. Sedan.
Small. It's very small. Compact, really.
Vicky and her boyfriend Logan stand in a parking lot at Sacramento State University, across from the football field. Vicky and Logan aren't their real names. We changed them for obvious reasons.
When we first started dating, I guess, we would spend a lot of time here. We would park. We would probably stay till like 3 in the morning.
In Sacramento County, about a third of 18 to 34-year-olds still live at home. Vicky is 22, in college, and her parents are uncomfortable with the thought of Logan staying over for the night.
I would say I was studying, and I don't know. They probably think I'm such a good student.
Vicky and Logan's parking spot is actually the exception, not the rule. Sex researcher Fisher says public sex is likely down among millennials and Generation Z because sex is just down for those age groups overall. And in an expensive state like California, moving out is no guarantee your love life will improve. Ian Baker works two jobs here in Orange County, one of them at this bowling alley. He's 29.
I've been out of my mom's for a little over a year now.
And how many dates have you gone on in that year?
Absolutely zero.
Ian has two roommates. He pays about $700 a month in rent.
Living with my parents, it actually wasn't that hard to try to meet girls and whatnot. Honestly, it became harder when I moved out, just because of the fact that in order to move out, you know, I had to start working two jobs.
The irony isn't lost on Ian, but he does have a step up on one of his roommates, the one who lives in the living room.
Well, I mean, like I said, at least I have a door. He doesn't, so I think it's a little bit harder for him.
In Orange County, I'm Matt Levin.
All right, here at KPCC, we are smack dab in the middle of beautiful Pasadena, California, City of Roses. If you can believe it, there was once a terrible fire, which then led to a race riot right off the intersection of Colorado Boulevard and Fair Oaks Avenue. You might have seen the plaque that's there marking the event, but there is oh so much more to this story. Hear what it is when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, I'm Martinez. Hope you're ready to travel back in time for some L.A. history because it's Thursday.
California, land of romance.
There is probably no single area holding so much of charm and beauty and the good things of life as Southern California.
Once a sleepy ranch town, now home to the stars of Tinseltown, the captains of industry and over 1 million men, women, and children.
There are boys and girls from the large cities and small towns. Each brings his dreams, his hopes, and his ambitions.
If you stroll through Pasadena just off Colorado and Fair Oaks on Mills Place, you may have come across it. A historical plaque that reads, in 1885, a fire at this site destroyed a laundry establishment owned by Chinese settlers. Well, seems pretty straightforward, right? Well, it's actually not. Robert Peterson is the host of the Hidden History of Los Angeles podcast. He's here to tell us what really happened back in 1885. Robert, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right. Before we get to the fiery violence that took place that night, set the scene for us. It's 1885. It's in Pasadena. What's the city like back then?
So in 1885, Pasadena was a small town of only a few thousand residents. And of those few thousand residents, about 60 to 100 were Chinese. But something that's important to keep in mind is in the 1880s, there was a very strong anti-Chinese sentiment among many segments of the Pasadena state and the nation. Just 3 years earlier, the federal government enacted the first federal legislation restricting immigration based on race, national origin, which was the Chinese Exclusion Act, which, interestingly enough, actually makes Chinese the first, quote-unquote, illegal immigrants in U.S. history.
Wow.
And also, if you read the papers in the 1850s, you see a lot of anti-Chinese arguments, things that actually sound pretty reminiscent of today, things that, you know, the Chinese are different than older immigrants, you know, they're just different immigrants, and that they refuse to assimilate or they're unable to assimilate, or they come from a culture that is diametrically opposed to American values, or, you know, it's unfair for American workers to have to compete with Chinese labor. So that,
just to be clear, you're talking about back then, not right now.
I'm talking
because
about,
that sounds exactly like we're hearing
I'm
today.
Exactly. Yeah. This is what you read in the papers. In fact, I'll give you one of my a quote from a paper in 1885 talking about the problems of Chinese immigration. Quote, "We have passed the point which the framers of the Constitution had in view when they invited the oppressed of all nations to seek asylum on our shores. We are now bound to protect our own people." That could have been written today.
Absolutely. All right. So clearly, racial tensions reaching a breaking point in Pasadena. What led to the riots, though, that took place that fateful November night?
It's November 6, 1885, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and a fire breaks out on Mills Place in a stable. And in 1885, Pasadena didn't have a fire department. So what they did is they actually rang the school bell and volunteers came to put the fire out. And they put the fire out. The stable burned down. Some hay was burned, and actually a cow was burned, but no one was hurt. But for some reason, the fire put the city on edge, and there were some rumors started circulating that somehow the Chinese were involved with starting the fire. So as the day went on and the night came along, a group of white men started congregating around a Chinese laundry on Mills Place. And at the time, Mills Place was home to a few Chinese businesses. And the congregation of white men started to get a little rowdy. One historian later wrote about it, quote, "A large number of men and boys were loafing, smoking, and talking Chinamen," unquote. So this rowdy group of men starts to grow. There's reports that they're talking about anti-Chinese slurs and arguments. And then someone in the mob throws a rock into the window of the Chinese laundry. The rock knocks over a kerosene lamp, which starts a fire. So the fire starts, the smoke and the fire start attracting more people. And suddenly now, the mob of a few men suddenly is a mob of 100 people. The fire grows, the Chinese are forced out of the building, and they come out onto Mills Place, and they're met with a mob of 100 people who start throwing rocks at them. And there's reports that people are yelling Chinese slurs, there's reports that people are threatening to lynch them. So the Chinese run to a nearby building where they barricade themselves inside. And it's important to realize how frightening that must have been, because not only did you have 100 people outside a mob, but just 14 years earlier in downtown LA, a similar incident happened where a white mob laid siege to LA's Chinatown, and 17 to 20 Chinese were killed, most of them lynched. So that must have been in the minds of these folks as they were sitting surrounded by a mob.
The way you say it too, Robert, it makes me think of a scene from like Gangs of New York.
Yes.
Kind of like just where everything is chaos, there's anarchy, and there's just people just going all over the place.
And that's actually, we forget that LA area was a little bit of the Wild West, yeah. And it was really only when we started, the railroad came and we became a little more urban, we got police forces. And luckily here, it didn't go down like it went down in LA, because a Pasadena police officer arrived on the scene, and he tried to quell the situation, and really the only way he could get the mob to disperse was to say, look, I'll make the Chinese promise to leave town if you guys disperse. So the police officer went in, met with the Chinese immigrants in the building. We don't know exactly what was said, but he probably said, look, there's a mob outside threatening to kill you. You need to leave town. And they agreed to leave, and the Chinese residents left town within 24 hours. The mob dispersed. And interestingly enough, the following day, Pasadena business leaders met together and drafted a resolution that basically said that no Chinese would be allowed to live in central Pasadena. And the borders were Lake and Orange Grove on the east and west, and Mountain and California on the north and south. And it was published in the papers. And this is essentially the first racially restrictive zoning rules in Pasadena.
Why is it so unclear what happened? Because that plaque says one thing, but clearly there's a lot more to that story.
Well, it's tough because, the accounts that we have of it come from a couple historical books and newspaper articles. And the newspaper articles aren't exactly clear what happened. And there also is a little bit of revisionist history. Sometimes, for example, in the LA Times, they report letters that were sent by some Pasadena business leaders that tried to blame the incident on the Chinese. And no one was brought to trial. If someone had been brought to trial, there would have been a court case and witnesses would have testified. We didn't have any of that here. No one was tried. No one was arrested for it. So we're left without all the witness statements and things that we usually would rely on to kind of describe exactly what happened.
Well, luckily, Robert, we have you to clear up history. Robert Peterson, host of the Hidden History of Los Angeles podcast. He spoke with us today about the historical plaque in Pasadena that doesn't quite tell the whole story. Robert, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
How many people have dreamed of coming to L.A. for film school to eventually become a movie mogul, only to get chewed up and sent back to wherever they came from by the cold machine that is Hollywood? I mean, too many to count, but only one of those Hollywood hopefuls went on to get a job that only 44 other people have ever had in American history. Yeah, the guy I'm talking about is only number 45. Find out who he is and why Hollywood did not warm up to him when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. Emmy Martinez. Before he was President Trump, Donald Trump was the quintessential New Yorker, a real estate mogul who was also tabloid fodder. Then came his reality TV hit, The Apprentice, which brought him national fame. And the rest, as they say, is history. But long before Trump became president, he was trying to make inroads in Hollywood, and that's the subject of LA Magazine's September cover feature. Alan Sulkin wrote the story, and he joins us now in studio. Alan, welcome to Take Two.
It's an honor to be here in Pasadena. Thanks.
Now, early in your piece, you make the point that most people don't think of Donald Trump when they think of Los Angeles, but he has a pretty long history here. So take us back to the first efforts he made to make a name for himself right here in Hollywood.
Well, as a kid, he wanted to go to USC film school. And he even says, you know, in a Playboy interview in 1990, that the ultimate job for him would have been a Hollywood mogul in the 30s and 40s, because you get a lot of control. And I think Donald is a guy who loved show business. He did attempt to buy the, or he was part of a syndicate that bought the land of the under the old Ambassador Hotel. He tried to invest in the Beverly Hills Hotel. This is, goes back to the 80s and into the 90s. But as far as, you know, Hollywood and really trying to make, he bought the Miss America, Miss Universe contest. Those were broadcast television shows that were for the most part shot here. So his dreams of being a player here were real, and I sort of contend are really what he would have done if he could have done anything he wanted. He really wanted to make it here more than just following his father's footsteps.
Now, he didn't wind up going to USC Film School. He studied business at the University of Pennsylvania before going to work for his dad's
which he always refers to as Wharton, which actually is the name of the graduate school that he did not attend.
Now, how did he parlay that into TV appearances?
Well, look, I was a reporter in the 1990s at the New York Post, and I would be remiss to not mention my own book, The Method to the Madness. It's a new oral history that starts with that period. But he loved media. He knew how to get himself into the gossip pages. We all had his number at the New York Post. He was good for a quote on pretty much anything. But one thing he always insisted on, I didn't follow this, but most gossip reporters did, call him a billionaire. And these were not people who had time to look at his tax returns, investigate, was he really still a billionaire? Was he ever a billionaire?
So he would insist on it.
He would insist on, this was the deal that he would make. He would feed you gossip. By calling him a billionaire over and over again, he created this persona that when, fast forward to when Mark Burnett, coming off the success of Survivor, and Conrad Riggs, his lieutenant, were thinking about how to cast a new business reality show, the first person they thought of was Donald Trump. He created an image of himself that was perfect for reality TV.
Like the image was waiting for a vehicle.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned The Apprentice, Mark Burnett. He eventually became the host of that show. This whole time, too, he's trying to pitch other TV shows, other ideas. I mean, tell us about some of the other ideas he had.
Yeah, he created a production company. This was his real bid to become a mover and shaker. With his own production company, he partnered with a fired apprentice named Andy Dean Latinsky, who went on to become a right-wing talk show host. And they pitched shows like The Girls of Hedzer Hall, which was like a show about how to get wayward young women back on track, and a show about three roommates who live together in an apartment, Miss USA, Miss Universe, and Miss some other beauty contest winner. He pitched a version with R.J. Cutler, a Hollywood producer, of Monopoly, which he partnered with Hasbro. That didn't happen. Some of these shows, the real low-budget reality ones, were the ones that actually worked for him, that got on the air for a limited run. He did one where Omarosa was the prize of a sort of bachelorette-like competition.
Like a dating show.
A dating show, and you would win Omarosa.
Talking to Alan Sulkin, he wrote the piece, The Biggest Loser, Why Donald Trump Couldn't Hack It in Hollywood. It's in the September issue of Los Angeles Magazine. Now, you make the point in the article that Trump's style of business that worked for him in New York isn't necessarily how things operate in Hollywood. It's not the way Hollywood does business.
Trump always saw himself as an outsider. I know for him, he was born in Queens, and he was always trying to make it into Manhattan. But he was able to, with his connections and his father's money, to become a mover and shaker there. But in L.A., relationships are everything. And he would go to, we have a quote from Jeff Klein, who runs the Tower Bar, which is, you know, one of the important dining rooms of Hollywood, Power. And Trump insists on sitting on the front table. And Klein calls him like Lisa Vanderpump, you know, a reality star, where he's like introducing him. There's no subtlety.
Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I barely knew who she was. I knew her name. In Hollywood, relationships go over years and years and years. And if you screw somebody over, it's remembered. And there's something about the real estate business in New York where, you know, you can keep just finding new partners and new partners and going forward. And so the idea that Trump, as a reality star, could pull off Now, he made a lot of money on The Apprentice, but the idea that he could pull off like what Ryan Seacrest did and turn reality show fame into real Hollywood power never materialized.
Now, on The Apprentice, though, we started to see the first little seeds of him maybe thinking about being president.
Yes. In fact, on the L.A. episode, on the L.A. season, there's an episode where he goes to give a speech in Minnesota and they show on TV a sign, somebody holding up, this is 2006, Trump for president. Even at a dinner with Wolfgang Puck, the candidates tell me that he was asked, went around the table, including asking Wolfgang Puck, do you think I should run for president? Now, Wolfgang, ever politic, apparently his Austrian accent got so heavy, you couldn't even understand his response.
All right, so Hollywood, for the most part, rejected Donald Trump. He had the hit with The Apprentice. That cannot be denied. But Hollywood has, does, and will reject scores and scores of hopefuls from here till time is over. Not an exclusive club. What's unique about highlighting Trump's run through Hollywood, then?
This is a guy who actually could have, you know, if he had played it right, he had a very successful reality show that was worth a lot of money. And going back in time, you know, he is a person who has proven that he knows how to get ahead. No matter what you think of him, he does keep ending up on top. And so it's sort of tantalizing to think, you know, I compare him to Charles Foster Kane, Citizen Kane, you know, of this foiled childhood ambition. Trump is now the president, but it's sort of tantalizing to think, well, is that really his dream? Is this the dream that so many of us have? Is this a guy who really wanted to make it in Hollywood? And being president is sort of the number two story.
But doesn't Trump have the ultimate win at the end of the day? I mean, he's president of the United States, arguably the most famous person in the world right now, and in a weird way has really cemented kind of a fame immortality. I mean, the title of your piece, The Biggest Loser, Why Donald Trump Couldn't Hack It in Hollywood, isn't he the biggest winner at the end of the day?
You know, I hate to give away the kicker of the article, the last word, but the last word is Rosebud. I think that says it. This is what he's wanted since I go back in the book to an interview with Rona Barrett, the great celebrity gossip reporter, celebrity entertainment reporter in 1980, where Trump talks about that one day he might want to be president, but it'd be unlikely for a guy like him with his hair and his not a great smile and all that, that he could ever become president. And yes, he strategized over decades about how to achieve that goal. And so being president was on his mind, and he does, you know, he did thread that impossible needle. But you still wonder, you know, a lot of us, I'm a journalist who's, you know, written a lot of articles, and I'm so happy to be in LA Magazine on the cover. You know, I grew up in Calabasas. It's a lifetime dream. But you know what? I'm a poet and a novelist who still hasn't published his first novel. Am I successful? Do I secretly at night wish, would I give this all up to just have like two or three really nicely reviewed novels that sold decently well? I don't know. Is this a man whose dreams are actually coming true? Or is he a person who's really never found out who he really was, who never was able to pursue his most serious, soulful ambition to be a creative person, to tell stories that are impactful without being what they are now, which he's telling stories in order to get, you know, these political gains? Does that really mean as much to him as having maybe made a Gone with the Wind of his own era? I actually, having researched this and thought about it, I think he'd rather have made a good classic movie that he could be proud of than to be president of the United States. I really do think that.
Alan Salkin wrote the cover feature on President Trump's Hollywood ambitions for the September issue of Los Angeles Magazine. Alan, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
If you missed any part of the show, or even if you heard every second of it, I urge you to hear it again. This was a good show, even if I do say so myself. Just go to wherever you get your podcasts, and there we will be smiling back at you, waiting to be heard. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. You can find me there as well, at AMartinezLA, AMartinezLA. Good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.